There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at UH1.com.
Episode 8 is about education economics. What does economics have to do with education? What are the proposed funding options for third level education? And how influential is location on third level accessibility? Dr. Dara Flannery of the University of Limerick has the answers. Okay, so very welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast, and I'm joined here by Dara Flannery, who's a lecturer here at University of Limerick, and today we're going to discuss education economics. So Dara, you're very welcome. It's great
Thanks
to have
Dan.
You. So to begin with, it would be interesting to think about, well, what is education economics? A lot of people would say, you know, education is a universal right. Where does the economics come into the whole situation?
I suppose economics come to it in terms of, you know, that the application of economic ideas, economic methods in the education space. We spend a lot of resources in education, obviously in terms of government spending, and we've across the globe a lot of resources dedicated towards education. So it's the application, as I said, in terms of economic principles and different methodologies towards the education space. Education is seen important, coming from almost like the macroeconomic model side of things, in terms of the link between education, the development of human capital and economic growth. So just the kind of macroeconomic link in terms of the individual level, that it's, you know, a link between education and development of individual human capital that enhances people's ability to earn, to get employment, to get higher levels of income. So that's where, and then interesting questions that kind of arise from that, you know, in terms of, think of basic economic concepts of efficiency and equity. Can apply those kind of concepts within education. You know, is there, in the system that we have in Ireland, for instance, at primary, secondary, maybe particularly higher education, you know, can we look at them through the guise of efficiency and equity to see if there's policy recommendations or policy suggestions that we can make?
Okay.
So that's where I think economics fits with education. Yeah, I agree with you in terms of people see it as a good, but, you know, at basic economics, we have scarce resources, so, you know, how those resources are allocated or distributed in the education sense is a kind of interesting kind of concept, I think.
Yeah, so maybe we can break that down a bit more. So, like, we only have so much money to spend on public services, and the idea is, I suppose, well, how do we best spend them?
Yeah.
And the best value for the individual then in a lot of these traditional models would be, well, what education can they get that is best for their well-being, their employment prospects, things like that? Would that be...
Yeah, like that would be kind of... There'd be a couple of strands of thought, I suppose, around in terms of the human capital theory, human capital framework, in terms of viewing education very much from an investment perspective.
Yeah.
So you'd, say, finish upper secondary, for instance, and you're deciding whether to go to higher education, whatever path you want to do, and the human capital approach, if you were to take that, would be to view it as an investment, that, okay, you face certain costs, and they might be upfront costs like fees, like accommodation, varying types of costs that you might face. And then from the benefit side of things, that you might accrue benefits to your, in the form of labour market benefits, particularly across your life cycle. So when you finish the degree for the next 40 odd years, you earn extra money and you have greater employment prospects because you went to college compared to if you didn't go to college. So it's like a cost benefit decision, but it's very much from the human capital perspective, from Becker's kind of human capital model perspective, it would be seen as an investment type process.
Right.
So from the individual perspective. Now, there are other strands of thought. I suppose you could see it as a consumption idea as well. You know, some people just like to learn, you know, so some people go to college and they like to learn. So, you know, that's a motivation or incentive for people to go. Again, I'm just using the example of higher education in terms of that choice. The investment side, look, you know, I say this in my first years, you know, people don't, I would imagine 17, 18 year olds don't sit down and get a spreadsheet and map out and kind of go, oh yeah, this and that. And but it might be there implicitly. Maybe they put, so different people put different weights in it. Maybe the parents put weights in it. Yeah. But that's the idea with that kind of, I suppose, a keystone kind of theory within education economics.
But then you could make the argument that the value isn't just how much money you can earn. It's how much you enjoy the work or where it brings you and other opportunities that come with it. So these are the things people think about, well, what job do you want to do? That would sort of fit into that model, I think, in that way.
Yeah, there's a return, like the kind of using the lingo inside the different returns to education. So, you know, they create the incentive for you to make a choice. They increase the perceived benefit as opposed to the cost that you derive from something. So in that case, education. So you might have a return to education from a financial point of view in terms of labour market and all the things I mentioned before. And there might be other benefits like, you know, the better quality of life, or you get a job that you enjoy more as opposed to having to work in a job that you don't enjoy as much. So from a life satisfaction perspective, there might be, you know, perceived returns there as well.
And so how would that influence policy then in that context? Should policy be directed towards promoting ones that have a greater likelihood of economic returns or non-economic returns? Or it's a tough decision, I suppose.
It is. Where policy kind of fits in, I suppose, is a couple of things. We could bring in other kind of economic concepts, for instance, market failure.
Right.
So if you just left the market up to itself, again, if we stick with higher education, because that's really where choices are made, because previous to that in your lifetime, a lot of it's compulsory education, so it's not, the choice isn't really yours as such.
Yeah.
If we stick with, say, the choice to go to higher education, from a government perspective, so economic concept of market failure, if you just left the private market up to itself, so in terms of higher education, the fees would be set by the private market, demand, you know, the interaction of supply and demand would set the quantity of enrolments essentially and the price. Now what that might do, and some people might think that's great, you know, because, you know, free market principles, some people might be of that persuasion, but even from an efficiency perspective that may not make sense, because you can get market failure. So for instance, if you get someone who's really, really clever and they get the highest achievement possible in upper secondary, but they can't go to college because of financial reasons, for instance, so that the household doesn't have enough money to send them. Yeah. That person, if they had gone to college, speaking hypothetically, they might have become a brain surgeon. And they might have, you know, and in that case, you'd have massive, massive social returns. They'd benefit, that person would benefit, but obviously you'd have massive social returns. So it's not efficient that person, you know, you kind of question begs, are you making the best use of your resources, your people as such as a country, if you let that happen? And you're not. I mean, you cannot, you know, from, regardless even of the equity perspective, if you even think that's not fair, and it probably isn't fair, but even from an efficiency perspective, it doesn't make sense. So what do you do? It provides justification for government intervention, like any market failure, as economics would suggest.
It fills the gap between what the private market would provide and what's best for society.
Exactly. And, you know, there's different ways you can go about that might be better or worse. In this country, we have grants, so, you know, maintenance grants, where people below a certain income threshold, they don't pay fees and they might get a maintenance grant. Now, you know, the nuances around the policy obviously are different a bit, but at a very broad level, that's the market failure, and that provides the government intervention. And this, another side then obviously is the equity side. So if you care about equity, you know, by that same example, is it fair that person can't go to college when their next door neighbour, who maybe didn't achieve as well in their upper secondary exam, but they can go to college because
they have the resources.
They have the resources. So if you care about fairness, what do you do in that case? You take money from some people and you give it to that person so they can go to college. So that's part of where the economics fits and I suppose provides the rationale for government intervention and government policy.
Yeah. So another thing after inspiring me there, and we can edit this out if I'm putting you on the spot, is this brings up issues like streaming in secondary schools and these sort of things. And there's a huge social trade-off there, but is there an economic literature behind these sort of decisions?
In terms of the secondary...
Secondary level.
In terms of literature, I'm not overly familiar in terms of the literature, in terms of streaming and those kind of things, in terms of upper secondary performance. What I suppose maybe that might be of interest is to have done some research recently with Kevin Denny in UCD and John Cullen in UIG in terms of kind of socioeconomic impact on upper secondary performance.
Right, okay.
Because we don't have good school level characteristics in there, like, for instance, streaming or things like that. But what we do have is information on their CEO points, essentially. So their performance in upper secondary and socioeconomic background and whether they went to a day school. So some school level stuff, but there isn't the kind of granular level detail and that kind of side of things. But you do see a socioeconomic gradient in leaving cert performance. In terms of the school characteristics, I think from a slightly, you know, I wouldn't say a great depth of knowledge in terms of that literature, in terms of upper secondary, you can get big deviations, you know, in terms of performance, even from primary school, people who are the same level of ability, things go very different in secondary. A lot happens in secondary level of education to either exacerbate or perpetuate differences, and even across gender, for instance, you know, that you get girls performing better than boys at secondary for whatever reasons.
So your socioeconomic analysis, were you able to pick out different traits that were associated with performing better in school?
Yeah, in terms of socioeconomics, so it was an overall measure in terms of the performance at secondary level, and particularly actually distributional performance, to see what helps people at the lower end as opposed to the upper end in terms of distribution. And I suppose what we found is that, you know, people at the lower end of the distribution, socioeconomics, there isn't much variation. Resources dedicated towards helping people at the lower end of the distribution, so kind of lower ability students and such, it's not really coming from the socioeconomics. There's something else going on in terms of their performance.
Okay, so it's not to do with the family background, these sort of effects, they're not driving the performance in school, there's something else that the data isn't really picking up.
At that point of the distribution, where it fits, I suppose, then, where the link, where it was motivated, in fact, actually, was that when you include, for instance, you look at the choice to go to higher education or not, in, say, the Irish kind of context, and when you include, when you control for certain factors, like CEO points, it almost mitigates the socioeconomic factors, because, you know, we have this, if you look at the raw data, you'll see, okay, you know, people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds are disproportionately not going to higher education, so, you know, you have a problem in terms of equity, but when you actually bring in and you control for CEO points, so their performance upper secondary, it mitigates a lot of that variation or that differences in participation in upper secondary. So what it's suggesting is actually the problem is further back. It's not at the point, or a large part of it isn't at the point of upper secondary. So it's something's going on in secondary that those people in lower socioeconomic groups aren't getting into third level because of maybe something that's happening further back in their lifetime.
So, okay, so another question then is, when we're talking about investment in education, and we want to, from a public perspective, from like the government wants to get the best bang for their buck, basically. And should they be directing money, should it be focusing on education that's good for industrial development? Should they be conscious of the fact that educated people, like there's this whole concept of brain drain, that they might leave Ireland and therefore they're not getting the return on their investment? How are these things that the government has to navigate?
Yeah, be cognizant of, so I mentioned earlier in terms of, say, the private returns and the government intervention with market failures and things, but there's obviously the social return side of things as well. So in terms of, again, say, going back to government motivation or government reasons for policy interventions, so the social returns are big ones, and part of that is things like externalities, for instance. So if I go to college and it makes me more productive, for instance, and makes me earn more, so I accrue benefits from that, but society might accrue benefits from that as well, because, for instance, I pay higher taxes because I earn more, so those resources can be used for different parts of society, whatever way the government decides. As well as that, as you mentioned, in terms of investment, so particularly for a country like Ireland, you know, as a trying to attract foreign direct investment, that forms a big part of our economic model as such. Having an educated workforce is it benefits society, you know, having dedicating resources, shall I say, towards having an educated society accrues benefits in other ways. So maybe it's through corporation tax receipts or, you know, subsidiary employment or things like that, that there are these returns. The other returns that in terms of that have been looked at is lower, for instance, lower crime levels, higher health levels, that there are these other impacts that society accrues because you have a population that's more educated. So in terms of the debate around, they're the things that I suppose if someone say, okay, why does government invest or should invest in education? They're the economic reasons or rationales that you would point towards. The difficulty, and this is the question that comes up, and it's relevant in terms of the funding debate for higher education and things, is how do you measure? You know, like, and where does the burden lie? So it's easy to understand the link between, okay, I go to college, that means I earn more, and there the benefit accrues to me. So by that rationale, you say, well, you should pay for education because you're the one deriving the benefit. From an economic perspective, you know, that's... But at the same hand...
There's a wider benefit for everybody else.
A wider benefit. Yeah. But quantifying those and comparing them to the other the private benefits, that's a very tricky kind of side. Even measuring the private benefits is a tricky exercise in terms of... you know, people have made careers out of trying to accurately measure those private benefits, the actual causal link, the explicit link between, okay, increased schooling and people earning money, extra money, you know. So the devil is in the detail, I suppose, in terms of trying to see that balance or try to best inform that balance between social returns, private returns, market failures. And that's where it becomes... possibly more of a judgment call or somewhat of a judgment call in terms of voters or governments, essentially.
Yeah, and like the pure economic approach maybe to think, well, what's the total benefit? What's the benefit? What proportion of that was the private benefit? What proportion of that is the public benefit? But that's very difficult. And then you think about things like, you see Dublin in the last 10 or 20 years becoming a hub for all these digital industries or whatever, but... It has a benefit for Dublin, has a wider benefit for Ireland, but also because this is a really popular area for these sort of technologies, that's attractive for bringing people in, talented people into Ireland as well. So this is another externality that Dublin is benefiting.
Agglomeration kind of affects Ireland.
Exactly, these are things that, very hard to quantify, but I suppose justify the public investment in the first place.
Yeah, there has been some research, you know, there have been individual studies, for instance, to look at the impact on crime. So to take advantage in change of years, so in terms of the methodologies used at a basic level, it's you know, take a change of years in compulsory schooling. So one cohort of one generation, for instance, had to stay in school till they were 15. The next generation had to stay in school till they were 16. Yeah. So to take advantage of that break in policy to see, okay, what's the causal impact? What has been the direct impact of having extra people educated, for instance, on crime levels, and they find crime goes down, or civic participation, so, you know, proportion of people's voting and things like that. And there is evidence for those. There's other instances, a guy called Walter McMahon, who's tried to bring all these things together and say, okay, where's the burden lie? Yeah. And I don't know if it's a typical kind of economist kind of answer, but it seemed to be 50-50.
Right,
that
was
the answer, you know? So, it is, you know.
So this whole human capital approach is one way of looking at education, but there's other theories out there like signaling. Now, signaling is something that I'm aware of when it comes to, you have to project that you have a certain ability or whatever. And I always thought of it as a bit like an old wives' tale as opposed to a formal theory, but there is a bit of a theory behind it.
Yeah. So the signaling theory, it was kind of, I wouldn't say a reaction, you know, or kind of to the human capital kind of theory. It's very different. It has very different implications in terms of even education policies. So I mentioned the human capital model. The assumption or the link that makes is that you get extra education, that makes you more productive. Yeah. Because you're more productive, that means you earn more. So kind of traditional economics, you know, you are more productive, the people who are more productive earn more. How do you get more productive? It's by building human capital, by getting the degree or whatever, you know, getting extra education. What the signaling kind of suggests is, there is this link between extra education and earnings, so it kind of agrees on that point. But it says it's for different reasons. It doesn't make the link between education and productivity.
Yeah.
All it says is that education gives you a signal that you may be productive, and it helps screen the marketplace between, say, different cohorts or different groups. So people who have degrees, they're generally more productive, or they give out this signal that they might be more productive.
Yeah.
How employers, for instance, how they screen through in terms of their hiring decisions is that they use this signal, this educational signal, essentially, to help them screen through the labour market and help them in terms of identifying people who may be productive. It breaks with the human capital theory, in that the human capital theory makes this explicit link between extra education means you are more productive and you earn more. The signalling doesn't make that link in terms of...
There's a bit of noise around the cause and effect, I suppose.
Yeah. And the implications, I suppose, why it's important in terms of implications is that, so with the human capital model, people are more productive because they get extra education. So therefore, it makes sense to invest in education, for instance, and, you know, going to college, and the systems that we have set up now kind of reflect that in a way. Yeah. Signalling would kind of put a question mark against that, because it would suggest, actually, is spending 4 years in college the best way to signal that you are a productive worker, or that you may be a productive worker?
Yeah.
Is there other ways you could design the whole education system to be able to screen for employers, or, you know, to have a system in such a way that it helps employers in a way in terms of screening their marketplace, in terms of demand for labour, that, you know, that college might be inefficient in that kind of way.
Right.
The college system that we have is inefficient. So there might be...
So the college system is based on the fact that you do 4 years, you develop a set of skills, and therefore when you go for a job, the job says, well, you've spent these 4 years, you have these skills. The signalling approach would say, well, you've spent the 4 years, you may have these skills. It's probably most likely that you do.
But you have a degree. So the degree tells me, or signals to me, that, okay, this person, as opposed to people without degrees, is possibly a productive worker.
So what's the alternative then, following the signal approach? Is it to have signals along the way, or better ways to test?
Can it suggest better ways to test in terms of whether people are productive workers? So maybe shorter ways, you know, does someone have to spend 4 years in college to get that signal? Is there a more efficient way to screen these people, or to get an accurate signal of these people into the labour market? So it's a different way of viewing the use of education, I suppose, or, you know, the motivation for it.
I suppose it relates to things like, I know in Limerick especially, there's a lot of job placements when it comes to degrees and things like that. So that might help with the whole signalling process.
Exactly,
Aspects like that in terms of...
But I say to my students as well, you know, in terms of human capital, that so the empirical evidence tends to lean towards the human capital, that it does improve productivity. You know, there's been a lot of studies to kind of look at both. The signalling empirical evidence is mixed, essentially. There's a thing called sheepskin effects that's been looked at. So to look at, okay, so if someone has 15 years of education as opposed to 16 years of education, the human capital model will say, what do they have? They have an extra year of education. So that's how, you know,
it's a marginal benefit.
Exactly, it's a marginal benefit. Whereas the signal would say, if you move from 15 to 16 and you get a degree, there should be a big jump in the link between, you know, that year of education and your earnings. You should see a spike in terms of, because you got a piece of paper.
Yeah, that makes sense though. Like, it makes intuitive sense to me that if you have the piece of paper, you're going to do a bit better.
Yeah. But the empirical evidence is, it's mixed in terms of taking I think different countries and different contexts have found different things.
Yeah.
So there isn't a uniformity, you know, or a kind of big headline study where this kind of recent study in Colombia that took advantage again of a policy break to look at the impact of the amount of education people get, the intensity of education people get in terms of contact hours or years in education and their productivity later on in work, and found a link between it. So it kind of supports the human capital framework in terms of get more education, you are more productive. So it's an interesting field, you know, that it's still kind of under the microscope in terms of empirical analysis.
And so another aspect then sort of struck me as interesting was the returns to different types of education change through time, and maybe it's like supply and demand, that maybe 20 or 30 years ago or more, if you got a PhD, you were at the top, basically, whereas now a lot of people, especially since the recession, a lot of people got PhDs and it maybe doesn't have the same earning power as it once had. Now, it definitely, you're not going to go too far wrong with a PhD, but I think supply and demand plays a role here, that there's more supply. So would these things change with time? Would this affect policy then, that maybe we should be trying to balance out oversupply in some areas?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the premium attached to higher levels of education. There is, you know, there's evidence in terms of there is a diminishing marginal return to years of education or levels of education. You know, that there is still a positive benefit in terms of earnings, and the OECD reports, and there's been reports in the US, not so much in Ireland, about returns to postgraduate education, for instance.
Yeah.
But there is a positive return in terms of your earnings from getting extra education. But it does have a diminishing, there is a diminishing effect to it. But, and that kind of makes sense. You think of it, you know, what's the return to reading and writing to an adequate level? The return is massive, like in terms of the labour market, even in terms of your daily life. If you can't read and write, so let's kind of equate that with a primary education, for instance. If you can't read or write or do simple maths to a basic level, you know, you're fairly hamstrung in terms of the labour market. So the return to that level of education is quite high.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a positive return as you go up, getting your leaving certs or getting your upper secondary education, getting a degree, master's, PhD. There's still a positive return. In terms of the returns to them over time, as I said, you know, in terms of supply, that one would imagine, you know, the supply has gone up massively.
Another interesting one was IT, because I remember when I was in school and I knew people who did IT degrees, and companies were coming in, this is in the late 90s, companies were coming in and pulling people out basically in the middle of their degrees and giving them jobs because there was such a shortage of people with that skill. And then two or three years later, there was that whole .com bubble burst and there were just, people had no jobs. But now, but after that, then that led to a shortage because people said, oh, that don't touch that area. And now there's, well, maybe there's still a legacy of that to a certain extent, but more people are going into that area again. But
so the cyclical kind of nature of it as well in terms of the labour market.
Exactly.
Like there is a, so the Seamus McGuinness in the SRI, he's done a lot of work in terms of skills mismatch.
Right.
And, you know, even say skills mismatch, that, you know, that this idea that there's over-education in the market, that the education system, I suppose, is not perfectly aligned in terms of the skills and competencies that are required in the labour market.
Yeah.
I think Seamus's research off the top of my head, I think, you know, has found that Ireland is pretty high on that by those measures of over education, metrics in terms of their labour market. But there is just kind of related point, the returns, there's a lot of heterogeneity around the turn. So, you know, you see kind of a lot of measures, and you see this in economics a lot, that there's an average effect of something, you know, so the impact of something on something, so education and earnings, and you get the average effect. But there's massive heterogeneity around it in terms of the returns to different things. So the returns to an arts degree is vastly different to the returns of a computer software degree or an economics degree, for instance, you know, but they might vary across time.
Yeah.
But people still do them. You know, people still want to do an arts degree, and they still want to do a degree in tribal dance or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because they like doing it. Brings back to the kind of start of the conversation that we had. You know, there's a consumption benefit to them. There's a social benefit to them.
Yeah.
You know, this, as a society, do we want everyone to have a computer software degree because that's what we, you know, that's the way the labour market is set up? My personal opinion, no. You know, that there's a social benefit to be derived from people doing other types of things. You might see the finance manager of a university might be happy about it because they're paying the same fee as someone else, you know, or the taxpayer mightn't be too happy because they're subsidising that person to the same degree as a nursing degree or a medical degree or whatever it is, someone who might earn a lot and pay a lot to the taxpayer, but there's a social benefit to be derived, you know.
Well, there is an economic argument in a different way, because if you're subsidising an accountant, well, it's a low risk subsidy because they're going to get a good job and they're going to contribute back and whatever. If you're subsidising somebody maybe in arts or whatever and who's going on to work in literature, there's a low probability somebody's going to have a huge impact, and that's going to have a huge social benefit then as well. So there is that, as well as the social impact that everybody benefits personally, there is the few who do really, really well that benefits, that the feedback comes back in terms of the value to the economy and to the rest of the welfare of everybody else.
But that's the difficulty, I think, you know, in terms of how you measure those returns, or how you as a society show preference towards those returns. You know, it's that's where there's a tricky area, you know, in terms of, because that relates obviously to financing then, you know. So if you don't care about that stuff, you put a lot of the burden on the private individual in terms of your financing, whereas if you do care about that stuff, you know, you want more of a mixture in terms of your burden.
So maybe we can move on then to some of your work in terms of Irish context. And I know you've done work on funding Irish education. Maybe you could just tell us a bit with that.
Yeah, so mainly higher education. So, so I suppose at the moment, the sector, I suppose the higher education sector, it's gone through a lot of flux in the last few years in terms of government funding has decreased significantly, whereas numbers, student demand essentially has gone up. So what that manifests itself in is a significantly decreased expenditure per student, for instance, in at third level education. So you, I suppose this is obviously viewed as a problem, that you have this increase in demand coming from demographics and different things, and you have falling resources. So how it's manifested itself, one issue, you know, we've, I think it's the second worst student staff ratio at third level education in the OECD. I think Turkey are the only country behind us.
Right.
You know, people point towards rankings, but okay, kind of give or take them in terms of their metrics. But, you know, in terms of research output and things that people point towards, that there is an issue at hand, and obviously in terms of funding and into the future as well, because demographically the projections are more people are going to go to third level education. So there has been options put forward. And there's been a thing called the Cassell's report 2-3 years ago now at this stage it was published, and it put forward different options. So the current system we have, okay, you have an upfront fee, 3,000 euros that students have to pay per annum, and some people get the grant, obviously, so roughly around 40-45% people might get the grant. That means they don't have to pay that fee, and they get they avail of that if they meet a certain income threshold, but the majority of people do have to face this fee. And I suppose my research has looked at in terms of alternatives, and some of the alternatives mentioned in the Cassell's report in terms of the redistributive nature of potential alternatives, and also the debate around them in terms of efficiency and equity, bringing back to basic economic concepts. So one of them is called an income contingent loan. It's a system that's been involved in the UK and in Australia. Like anything, you can do something badly and you can do something well, any kind of system that you design in terms of financing. So it's an alternative to, a proposed alternative, should I say, in terms of the current system that
we have.
So
would that be like a loan that you get, your fees are covered, but then when you start earning money, you pay back, and the amount you pay back depends on how much you're earning?
Exactly, yeah, the keyword contingent, exactly, And that, as opposed to, and that's, I think, you know, that is something that's lost in the debate. A lot of, you know, that word loan, debt. You think of your mortgage, you think of your car loan. And they're called mortgage-style loans in the sense that, and it's like the US system, theirs is very much a mortgage-style loan. So you borrow, you sign an agreement to say, look, I will pay back, say, 500 euros a month for the next 10 years or whatever it is. And that's what you pay back. No matter what your income is, no matter what you have a spell of unemployment or whatever it is, that's what you pay back.
That's what you pay back in the States, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, that type of mortgage system. As opposed to the income contingent loan, it would be, there'd be a lot more mechanisms or parameters on. For instance, there would be an income threshold at which you start repaying back. So, for instance, if you come out of college and you don't meet that income threshold, for whatever reason, in terms of your spell of unemployment, you don't pay back anything. That's where the taxpayer comes in. The taxpayer takes some of the risk, takes some of the burden in terms of this funding. So once you reach that threshold, then you start repaying. And again, you can the devil is in the detail in these things, and you can design a system to be okay. Say you pay 10% of any income, and 10% of any income you earn above a certain threshold, that goes back towards servicing your loan, for instance.
And then, so would there be perverse incentives that, oh, I could get a promotion here and earn more, but that means I have to pay more on my loan, and therefore I might just stay where I am?
Yeah, but like the tax system, you know, it's the exact same as the tax in terms of marginal taxes, you know, so it's not too dissimilar from that kind of side of things. So the key is, I suppose, in terms of a threshold, is to not set it too low that you're capturing graduates who mightn't be deriving any benefit from the degree, that they can't get a job. So they're not deriving any benefit. So it's not really efficient or fair to take money off them, and not to set it too high either that you don't capture any money. In terms of the first incentives, like I said, it's like the income, like any income tax system, that you, progressive income tax system that you have in the world, you have the same thing. The alternative, if we compare it to the alternative, for instance, in terms of the current system that we have, it's an upfront fee.
Yeah.
So what it does is it takes away, and you, this is my economist hat, it kind of, you know, it may, from an efficiency and equity kind of viewpoint.
Yeah.
If you have that poor household, for instance, that person who I mentioned earlier that got, did really well in their upper secondary education, but can't go because they see €3,000 fee,
yeah,
for instance, and they say, or even if they're not low income, for instance, because the grant might cover them, they say they're in that threshold that it doesn't cover them, that, that point at which they can't qualify for a grant,
yeah,
but maybe the €3,000 fee is too much for that household.
Yeah.
So they're caught.
Yeah.
So that kind of person in an alternative income contingent loan system, for instance,
yeah,
goes for free. They don't pay anything.
Yeah.
What they pay back depends on what they do with themselves later on in life. It's not contingent on their parents' income. It's not contingent on their household income. What they pay back is contingent on them throughout their life cycle.
And so at what stage of consideration would this be in the whole policy?
Oh, pipeline? God. So it went to higher education. So on the policy side of things, the report went to a committee, Higher Education Future Funding of Higher Education Financing Committee. The committee's report back to the minister. They didn't really make a recommendation in terms of what option from the Gazelle report to follow through with.
Yeah.
Instead, it's now with the European Commission to do an economic analysis of the different systems proposed. So the other systems proposed was the status quo,
yeah,
in terms of a bit of government funding and the student, what they call the contribution charge, for a very nice name, as opposed to a fee, you know.
Yeah.
Or else get rid of that, increase government funding. Then the third option was to continue government funding but bring in this, what do you call it, income contingent loan system. So currently it's with the commission essentially to do an economic analysis. Part of my research coming back, you asked in terms of my research, is, has been to do kind of an economic analysis on it from the point of view, for instance, the redistribution of impact of it. So what my, it was part of my PhD actually with my supervisor Carla Ladonio, who you know. Was to look at, to simulate the impact of bringing in an income contingent loan.
Yeah.
You know, so to try and simulate earnings into the future for graduates and then impose this kind of loan system on them and see, okay, what happens in terms of repayment rates? How long does it take them to repay back?
Yeah.
What proportion of graduates repay back? And you have to make certain assumptions, you know, around what earnings will grow at per year, and you're going to make conservative assumptions. And
yeah,
we found it was roughly around 75% of graduates would repay their loan in full.
Okay.
You know, from a certain system, you know, so we said €10,000 in debt. The start rate, the income threshold I mentioned before was around the average industrial wage. That's when it kicks in, the repayment. You can play around with those parameters, and you can
measure. Sure,
Aideen Doris in Maynooth has done similar research and found a similar result, which is, I suppose, somewhat reassuring, but different data set.
So you focus on the distribution, the fact that it's more progressive, that it helps people in lower income groups a bit more.
Lower earning graduates. So the lower earning graduates, for instance, it's not dependent on what their household looks like, what they're born into, essentially. It's how they post-college. So lower earning graduates repay less. That's a function of the system.
Yeah.
Higher earning graduates pay back more. They'll pay back their loan in full, for instance, whereas lower earning graduates won't. Now, as I said, the debate around it is, it's heated, obviously, you know, because it's a very important topic. A lot of information gets skewed, I think, in terms of the debate. You can bring in things, for instance, which I think Aideen Moore looked at with Bruce Chapman, an Australian colleague, is the idea of repayment burdens, which they have in the Australia. So you can actually cap the repayment on any given month or any given year that people face. So you're not paying back, you know, €500 in any given month. So So there are mechanisms you can put in a system.
Yeah.
You can do it badly. The UK have done it badly.
Right,
and that's the one that's point. If you want to look for a bad income contingent loan system.
And why is it bad in the UK?
Because they've done things like they have gotten rid of their maintenance grant system and they included the grant as a loan now.
Right, okay.
So, for instance, instead of having a grant system,
you it's know, a loan.
It, they've converted into loans. What you're doing there is you're just giving lower income people more debt.
Yeah.
Which is just ridiculous. And that's never been...
I don't know much about the UK system, but it seems to be much more burdensome in terms of the loan that you're shouldered with.
Yeah, like even the amounts. So what they, you know, the amounts that they do. If you compare it to the Australian system, the actual fee amount, basically, or the debt that you accumulated is higher relative to Australia as well.
Yeah.
If you look at the politics of it, when did that happen? It's happened post 2010-11 when a certain party wasn't, you know, so it's, you know, there's this political side to it. Now, you know, you could say in Ireland that could happen as well, in terms of if you brought in a system, it's at the political kind of whim. There are mechanisms you can do, you know, you can link it to inflation, you know, you can possibly legislate even for different things in terms of, look, you could, this is the fee, it can increase with inflation in any given year. That's the parameter, you know, you can set certain parameters around it that potentially take the more political side out of it, given where we are now in terms of the current system. You know, like, if the government came around tomorrow and said, look, you know, okay, the Casella's report recommended, I think it was 300 million more per annum to meet demographic needs, essentially to keep student staff races essentially at current or at international norm levels as such. And if they came around yesterday and said, we're going to do it, that'd be great. But are they going to do it? You know, the political reality of it. We're not really...
To get over. So one other question then is, so you've done other work on accessibility to college and in terms of a spatial context and different people from different locations and their accessibility to higher level education.
Maybe
you could say a bit on that.
Absolutely. So this is a bit of research with mainly done with John Cullen in the OIG and Sharon Walsh in the OIG. So what we've done is what motivated actually was an initial study to look at see if distance impacted the decision to go to college. And what we found was that we saw variations by social class. So distance mattered, but it mattered for people from lower income groups. Which kind of makes sense that it provides, you know, that it provides a bigger disincentive for people to go to college if they're further away from college. But the impact is bigger on lower income people because the higher costs, obviously accommodation, those kind of things are a greater impediment to those people. So then that kind of led in terms of a different study in terms of, okay, what is the accessibility like in Ireland? You know, and if you look at it, so we did some, John kind of does the spatial analysis side of things to look at, okay, what does accessibility look like? From a country perspective, overall, it looks good. It doesn't look too bad. So you can, we have maps that we've produced to look at the overall higher education system. What I mean by that is universities and institutes of technology. So we're kind of well covered. However, if you, the point of view we kind of looked in is, all right, but you know, if you want equal opportunity for people on the Republic of Ireland, so you and I, no matter where we live, that we have equal opportunity from a spatial perspective. Somebody thought, what about universities? Because there's obviously big differences what you can study in a university versus an IoT. You can't do medicine, for instance, in an IoT. And what we found there was massive variation. So there was very, there is very poor accessibility to university education or to get to a university in the southwest of Ireland and the northwest of Ireland. So basically kind of Mayo.
The extremities,
The extremities. But even what we've done, a couple of different approaches then is looked at, even you can weight it by population, for instance, young people. So you could, you know, because part of the counter argument there would be, well, not many people live in Mayo, so, you know, so it doesn't really matter that you're not accessible to university because there's not many people. But even when you weight it by things like young people, the population of young people, it's still, there's still areas of the country that are poorly accessible.
So, so you, so how did you measure accessibility then?
So accessibility, you can measure it in a couple of different ways. You can do it just by distance. So you can do just, so the distance from different parts of the country to HEIs, essentially. So if you stick with the universities, so obviously it's kind of fairly obvious then that the southwest is, so West Kerry is poorly, it has a low accessibility measure because it's far away from UL and it's far away from UCC. That's a very kind of simple metric. There's other metrics you can use in terms of, you can use this thing called a system-wide accessibility measure, where it's getting someone's distance to every single university in this case from where they're from, or from that area, should I say, you know, from the kind of area in the country. Then you do that for every area, every electoral district in the area, essentially. And then you you can create, the best way to look at it is visually, that you have a map that you can see, okay, this place is very poorly, has poor accessibility to universities, not just to its nearest university, but all universities, because it's far away from everything, essentially. So for, I suppose an example of that, how that might play in terms of policy, for instance, in terms of link, there's been a big move towards technical universities. And a big move, for instance, in the southeast to change in terms of Waterford IT to a technical university.
Right.
But what we found was actually the southeast isn't as badly doesn't have a lower, an extremely low accessibility metric, because it's compared to other parts of the country, like the Northwest and like the Southwest, because it's closer to places like UCC and it's closer to places like UCD, Maynooth.
Yeah.
So it kind of plays into policy that way as well.
But there's also the fact, the aspect of household resources of, you know, it might be a long way to go for college.
Yeah.
But if you can afford to live outside of the home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, then it's more accessible, I suppose.
So part of our research, I suppose, in terms of the accessibility measure just gives a picture of accessibility.
Yeah.
You know, that's the broad picture in terms of accessibility. The other research, I suppose, breaking into the micro detail of, in terms of, okay, who does distance matter for?
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah,
it matters for the lower income households.
Yeah.
So it's, in terms of a spatial point of view, yeah.
And were you able to take that into account that these, well, I imagine rural areas tend to have lower incomes, so, and these are the areas that are less accessible, so there's probably
It's a difficult one to see, to be honest, because of data in a way, you know, like in terms of data, in terms of progression, actually tracking people from upper secondary to third level.
Yeah.
So for instance, the data we had to use was the 2007 school leavers data.
Right, okay.
That's the latest data. Now, the GUI, the Growing Up in Ireland survey, might change that, but it's only up to
70. When it comes to that stage.
Exactly, yeah. When it comes to that stage. But that's part of the problem. So in terms of our research to look at the progression or the impact of distance ongoing, it was relatively old data, you know. So a lot has happened, obviously, in terms of fees,
Since 2007, yeah. That's just before the crash, yeah.
Like, John has done some separate research at a school level to look at flows, because you can get information at a school level, look at a couple of different characteristics in terms of school level and see flows at that level. But at the individual level, where things like household income, you know, the kind of micro level detail comes into play, it's a far trickier proposition because, I said, data constraints, you know. So that's part of the reason we went to look at that broad picture of accessibility. The next bit of research that we did do actually was part of Sharon's PhD, was to create her own data. So Sharon, her poor old Toyota, traveling around the country to get a sample of secondary school students.
Right,
for to fair. See. It was motivated by this idea of, does distance matter?
Yeah.
But then the how it kind of evolved or snowballed was, okay, would people trade off distance for other characteristics of, you know, would they be willing to travel to a higher education institute if it was a really good one, for instance, or if it had a good course reputation, or if it had a work placement available? So were there certain characteristics of HEIs of higher education institutes that they'd be willing to trade off? So Sharon's done that as part of her research to see. We found is, in terms of attributes that are important, distance matters, so people care about distance.
Yeah.
But what people really, really care about is the course reputation. But the reputation, what I mean by reputation is the impact on you getting skills and knowledge that help you in the labour market. That's what, and it was a sample of upper secondary students.
That's really interesting. And I wonder, does that perception change with the person's background? Because, for example, for me, I didn't know much about different reputations of different colleges when I was in secondary school, whereas maybe that's changed and maybe people are a bit more savvy now.
They're mixed. Anecdotal now, you know, I think students are getting a bit more informed, I think, you know, for whatever reason. Maybe it's through career guidance or better career guidance, I don't know. But I will compare to from doing just standing at a stand in open days.
Yeah.
I seem to be getting more good
questions.
Yeah, better questions about, you know, specifics about the course and things like that. So maybe they're more motivated. But yeah, in terms of the
didn't come out in your research though, obviously. Well,
there was heterogeneity, not that specifically, but there was heterogeneity around. So we collected information around their socioeconomic background and other kind of things as well, you know. It was what's known as the discrete choice experiment, was the approach taken, which is using environmental economics and health economics a lot, but this was kind of an application education economics. There was heterogeneity found in terms of, okay, lower income backgrounds prefer, people from lower income backgrounds, should I say, prefer certain attributes, and there was heterogeneity around them. But the headline kind of news, I would say, from the research was that there was a consistent message that course reputation mattered,
even from lower socioeconomic groups.
To varying degrees, you know. Okay. So, but it was course reputation that mattered from a student population. That was and a work placement, you know, the kind of the labour market characteristics. It kind of goes back to the human capital idea, actually. In fact,
yeah,
that we kind of looked at and thought, geez, the students are worried about can their higher education institute enable them
to get a good job?
Get a good job, essentially, which kind of lends its, you know, in a somewhat indirect way back to the human capital thing, that are they thinking about this stuff as they're formulating their choices, you know?
Yeah, no, that's definitely really interesting. And so leading on to that then is a lot of the issues that are arising now, it's only going to exacerbate the problem that accommodation is a lot more expensive. I remember when I was doing my undergrad in Galway, it was like €300 a month for a room, and I'm sure it's double that now. Yeah. And Dublin is crazy. Yeah. So that really makes it more difficult for people who need, first of all, people who need accommodation, and secondly, people who are low socioeconomic groups who also need accommodation.
You're going to cut, like, what that'll do, you know, it'll cut off options for people and choice sets, to use the economic parlance, or, you know, like, it'll cut off choices that, you know, parents will have to say to people, look, you're going to UL, John or Mary, because I don't care if you want to do undergraduate medicine, it's not available, but, like, we can't afford it. Part of that, okay, there's no one solution to most of these things, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing that would strike me in terms of would be the grant. You know, so when's the last time the grant increased in terms of the actual amount that's given towards? And how is it relative to rent in Dublin, for instance?
Yeah.
You know, so it's you could pay, for instance, I would imagine, you know, you might, in terms of your accommodation costs for 1 year of undergraduate education, if you're going to UCD or Trinity or wherever it is, I'm Dublin, DCU TU Dublin, you know, you could pay $7,000 maybe over the course of the academic year, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, the grant isn't going to come near covering that, you know.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And so that comes back to the funding kind of side of things. If you know, if the pot isn't big enough from the government side of things, you know, does something have to change? The government increases the pot, or you change the system in some kind of way that pot can get bigger.
To think about it from the economist's perspective, the problem here is that the cost is so great that people's choices are being limited, or potentially might be limited. So we need to try and change the gap from what people would do given their constraints versus what they would do if they were unconstrained, and try and allow them, the good people, to go to places that will serve them best, basically, and not have these constraints being imposed on them.
It's market failure again. You know, it's that you get people making kind of suboptimal choices because of credit constraints. You know, so accommodation costs, for instance.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's and that lends itself towards a government intervention. You know, what's the next step? So government intervention.
Yeah.
Now we have government intervention in the form of grant, but
it doesn't
fit purpose.
Yes, it's all the market failure. Okay, Darragh, thanks very much. I think we're sort of covered pretty much everything.
Yeah. Thanks a million.
That was, yeah, it was really interesting, and appreciate your time.
Thanks, Niall. Thanks a million.
Thanks to everybody for all the messages of support over the last while. This has been a labour of love so far, so they really have meant a lot. Please keep the messages coming and let me know what you like, what you don't like, or any suggestions for future episodes. A tweet or Instagram message to @IrishEconPod is really appreciated. Remember to keep spreading the word. A community is growing around the podcast now, which is really great, and we really want to keep the conversation going as much as possible. So tell your friends, family members, colleagues, anyone you think might be interested. If doing so online is easier, remember to tag us @IrishEconPod on social media, and we'll help spread the word further again. So thanks everybody, and all the best.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.